The old normal is gone.
Stationarity is dead when it comes to the natural conditions here on the Earth. And I am a journalist mostly in the economic and political sphere. So basically, when I started sort of raising my eyes to this idea, I realized that the same concept is pretty much at play in the political and economic realm.
That's Mark Shapiro. His new book is The End of Stationarity, Searching for the New Normal in the Age of Carbon Shock. Then, if the presidential election was rigged, as Donald Trump has claimed, then who rigged it?
Donald Trump says the election's rigged, and he ought to know because his buddies are rigging it.
That's Greg Palast. We talk with him about his new book and movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. For the past 12,000 years at least, human civilization has depended on a natural world that observed largely constant rules. These rules governed how much water we had to grow food, the temperatures of our seasons, and how severe our weather was, but no longer. Now all bets are off as we enter the era of climate disruption. The old normal is gone, and we don't even know what the new normal will be. The impacts will profoundly shake our economic and political foundations. They already have, as droughts affect food prices in the U.S. and abroad, insurers withdraw from covering coastal properties, and carbon shock roils the energy markets. My guest Mark Shapiro has been following the widening ripples as the gigantic boulder of climate change crashes into society. We spoke with him last about his book, Carbon Shock. Now he's followed up with a new book, The End of Stationarity, Searching for the New Normal in the Age of Carbon Shock. Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative journalist. He was formerly senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting and is the author of two previous books we've talked with him about, Exposed and Carbon Shock. Well, Mark Shapiro, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
And it's great to have you here. This book, The End of Stationarity, very much within the line of what we have been talking about with you over the years. Each time it seems that the lens becomes wider. And here with the end of stationarity, searching for the new normal in the age of carbon shock. First of all, just tell us, what does the title mean? What does stationarity mean?
Well, first of all, I'm happy to hear if the lens is getting wider, actually, because, I mean, the more you get into this arena of environmental conditions here on the planet as a journalist, the wider my lens, I guess, does become. And so I appreciate you putting it that way. The end of stationarity, the word stationarity is a concept that I actually learned in the course of reporting on climate change. And it comes from this concept. A number of water scientists about nine years ago, were studying the patterns of water falling onto the planet as rain, and they realized, to their great surprise and a discovery they were very disturbed by, to realize that the past patterns of water flow onto the planet were no longer predictors of future water flows. So stationarity refers to this concept in the sciences of a kind of a predictable range of variation. And that range of variation basically allows you to basically understand how things have happened in the past when it comes to water and how they would happen in the future. In other words, there'd be predictable ranges of variation. What they realized in studying water was that climate change was so disruptive to the atmosphere that they could no longer say that past patterns of variation would hold in the future. And they wrote a paper, which is an amazing paper for anybody who enjoys reading scientific papers, and they called the paper Stationarity is Dead. Stationarity is Dead is a paper that appeared in Science magazine and was just like a shockwave to the whole scientific community, because suddenly all bets were off in terms of actually understanding how to plan for this kind of like a crazy world that they were predicting when it came to water flow. And their paper set up a huge discussion in the kind of water community, which, trust me, there is a big water community out there. And that water community is getting bigger and bigger as we speak, as people begin looking to the sky and realizing that actually the flows of water that we counted on in the past are no longer going to be coming our way. And water is falling at different times. It's falling in, you've kind of drought happening in many parts of the earth. In other parts of the earth, you have massive floods, complete disorientation when it comes to water flow. And in response to a huge discussion in the water community, they actually did another paper, which came out just 1 year ago, in which they actually reiterated and really doubled down on this observation. By the way, these are some of the top scientists in the world, including one of our own U.S. Geological Survey. So I thought this was, number one, a very important concept to understand. Stationarity is dead when it comes to the natural conditions here on the Earth. And I am a journalist mostly in the economic and political sphere. So basically, when I started sort of raising my eyes to this idea, and I realized that the same concept is pretty much at play in the political and economic realm as it is in the natural realm, and how climate change is a completely disruptive force onto past kind of economic models as well as kind of political systems. So that's why I titled this book, The End of Stationarity, and the subtitle, as you know, is Searching for the New Normal in the Age of Carbon Shock. So it's a look essentially at how the disruptions that we're becoming somewhat familiar with in the natural realm have their corollary in the political and economic.
And is there even the possibility of a new normal in a time where everything is in, you know, all the ways we've been looking at the world, both economically, politically, and of course, from the point of view of climate, are in such flux and chaos?
Yeah, well, that's actually a very good question. I think new normal is a little bit of a shorthand for, I kind of actually like the word also equilibrium. It's kind of like the, we're searching for a way to regain our equilibrium in the face of these enormous changes. So I think the new normal is a kind of a shorthand for this idea that the Earth and that political and economic systems are basically striving to actually obtain a sense of equilibrium in the face of all these changes. So you call it new normal, you can call it equilibrium. I think you're right in the sense that new normal presents some kind of concept that there's a kind of a stasis that we will obtain, this kind of moment of stationariness, which I think you're right is not what we're going to be getting. But the new normal, I think, is a way to understand how the political and economic order is going to be dealing with these kind of challenges to old ways of doing things, which is, I think, very clear is a state that we're in right now. And that is the new normal. The new normal is this kind of, how are we going to deal with a world in which our calculations of energy, how we account for our energy is very different, a world in which resources that were once not valued at all are suddenly become extremely valuable, and other resources that have been highly valued, for example, oil and other fossil fuels, are going to diminish in value, and what that does to our economic system, which is it's highly disruptive of it. Could be in a very positive way, a positive disruption, but nevertheless a real dynamic disruption. And that's what I write about in the book, is this kind of dynamism that's now at play in the economy and the political order as new concepts enter into the system.
Yeah, and when one is talking about the end of stationarity, that is the end of assumptions that the future is going to more or less look like the past, that calls into question the fundamental bases upon which things like the insurance industry are based. In other words, how does one plan for the future and how does one insure against catastrophe when one has no idea what's going to happen?
That is just a phenomenally good question. And it's a question that we should all be dealing with on a regular basis. I think the It applies to insurance, but it also applies to many other industries, whether it's food companies, energy companies, manufacturing companies, a whole array of consequences. So, but insurance is a great model because they are, if you want to kind of understand where the world is headed, it's a good idea to actually start looking at the insurance companies, not because they're a bunch of raging environmentalists, but because they have their money on the line, basically, as this kind of world changes. And I think the insurance companies are really at the forefront, in a way, of trying to understand and account for these risks that are coming. There's actually some major kind of insurance company think tanks that I quote in the book who talk about how we need a new paradigm of risk. We need to actually beginning to look at risk in new ways. And I think that where insurance companies are now looking, number one, let's see where they are looking very clearly. Number one, they're looking at coastlines and how are you going to insure homes. And actually, there's a great deal of retreat from insuring homes along coastlines because of the hurricanes, because of the rising sea levels. Actually, big chunks of coastline are actually disappearing. Floods are becoming more common. And so insurance rates, number one, are rising, which is one way the insurance company responds and will kind of rise and at kind of very high rates of rising. So it's going to be more and more difficult to actually build a home at all on coastlines. What's also interesting is the crop insurance system. The crop insurance system is in a state of real crisis. The crop insurance system, which is extremely complicated, and we won't go into exactly how it works, but just trust me when I say that, you know, at least 60% of all the premiums paid to farmers for crop losses are covered by the United States government. So the U.S. government itself now actually sees the crop insurance system in a moment of crisis because they're having to pay out so much money for drought and the rising temperatures in food country all across America. So it's not even clear that the crop insurance system can continue in the current way that it is right now, because premiums are kind of, the premiums are getting more expensive, and more importantly, even the payouts have been skyrocketing over the past 10 years when it comes to crop losses. So the insurance industry is actually a great way to actually begin to understand this kind of dynamism at play as the kind of global economic system kind of wakes up to these huge financial pressures. I would add one other thing, Francesca, which has been interesting to see. You know, I was at the Paris climate negotiations last year, and what was very interesting was at that time the head of the Bank of England, which is essentially the Federal Reserve Board of the United Kingdom, has now been asked by the G20 economies to analyze the stresses that the most advanced economies in the world face from the risks of climate change. So right now we have former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg heading up a task force that is assessing the financial stresses being faced by the world's major economies. So I'm not saying this to toot the horn of Mike Bloomberg or anything along those lines. The point of raising this is that even the most mainstream large financial institutions of the world are beginning to see the kind of financial risks being faced by, you know, major economies around the world.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with investigative journalist Mark Shapiro about his latest book, The End of Stationarity, Searching for the New Normal in the Age of Carbon Shock. I'd like to go back to crop insurance, Mark Shapiro. In this book, The End of Stationarity, you visit California. You did so in your last book, Carbon Shock, as well, but are advancing the reporting in this one. We are now, I think California is in the sixth year of a drought. Is that right? With no end in sight?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
it's a very dry state.
Yeah, and you are there. That's where we're calling.
I am here in California. I live in Oakland.
Uh-huh. So you talk.
We are very aware of not having rain.
Yeah. You talk about the impact on food, not just in California, of course, but also around the world. But you visit cherry country, you know, and talk about what you found there and what the implications are for this drought? I mean, we don't know yet whether this is going to be an actual mega drought lasting decades. So can California agriculture survive?
Well, that's a very good question. And like you mentioned, I went down to Cherry Country in California, which is about an hour and a half south of where I live in Oakland. And this is in the San Joaquin Valley, one of the powerhouses of food growing in the United States. And one of the crops that it's actually very well known for are cherries, and these delicious red plump cherries we've become accustomed to are becoming less common than they used to be. And I'll tell you why. I went down to Cherry Country, and some people might have had the pleasure of coming to California Cherry Country in the springtime, and all the blossoms come out, and it's quite beautiful. And you can get cherries, the traditional spinach, you get big handfuls of these juicy red cherries. Well, I went down there and I visited some farmers, including the guy who heads up the California Cherry Council, which is, you know, the mega trade association for cherry growers. So he knows his way around cherries. And he walked me through his field. And what you see are trees that have been stunted by the rising hot temperatures in the Central Valley and in Cherry Country. And cherries are, in a way, many scientists now identify cherries as being like the canary in the coal mine for when it comes to crops. And what you see are declining yields in Cherry Country. The trees that this gentleman showed me through on his farm, you could see at the top third of the tree were these kind of beautiful, lovely cherry blossoms, which from afar are still quite lovely, flickering in the light breeze, those beautiful pink and red cherry blossoms. But in the bottom two-thirds of the tree, you saw all sorts of kind of stunted cherries, half coming out of their buds. Some branches completely empty of cherries, all of which is not immediately visible if you're whizzing by on the highway, because you still see the nice flickering flowers on the top part of a tree. And what this suggests is when the cherries come off these trees, too, they're finding more and more of these kind of distorted cherries, those kind of double cherries that grow together, which is a sign of high stress on the trees. And what they're noticing also is a significant drop in yields in Cherry Country. And the reason that they are surmising, I think it's basically understood now, is that plants like cherries need a period of cold. They need a period, usually it happens in the wintertime, when it gets cold enough that the fruit itself can almost like hibernate and hold on to preserve its energy, so that when it gets warmer, traditionally in, you know, starting in, you know, February, March, then April starts getting a lot warmer, those hibernating, if you want to call it that, kind of buds just, you know, explode with all that beautiful, radiant, red, and plump cherry. But it's not getting cold enough in the winter, so that as a result, the cherries are being stunted. And I think if you start to, and cherries are by far the most sensitive of these tree crops, but actually we're starting to see similar phenomenon with apricots and with peaches and with other kind of tree fruits. And if you extrapolate from that to many, many other crops, we're actually seeing a lot of people in Cherry Country, including this man whose farm is outside of Lodi, not far from Stockton, for those familiar with California, are really grappling with whether over the next 5-10 years they can even continue to grow cherries here in California. And these are the kind of stresses that farmers that I talk to, many farmers all over the Central Valley, are dealing with: the pressures of the rising heat and at the same time the diminishing water. And one of the effects of that is just hundreds of thousands of acres throughout the Central Valley being fallowed because of the lack of water and the rising heat.
And these grow something like 95% of our crops, not wheat and corn, but our vegetables and fruits.
Exactly. In the Central Valley of California, is probably out there in New England or wherever people might be listening to this show, or is a good chance they are eating the fruits and vegetables that come from the Central Valley, all of which are now being placed under extreme high stress due to the diminishing water supply and the rising heat. And so right now it's a very tense situation where farmers are, for the first time, really uncertain about what the future is going to be for their farms. I mean, the Central Valley is this huge area that has been largely reliant on irrigated water that falls traditionally in the Sierra Mountains to the north and freezes during the winter when it gets cold and then rolls down, rollicking down the hillsides, and is pumped down into the Central Valley to irrigate these areas. And what we're finding is that it's not getting cold enough, number one, to freeze that water when it does fall in the winter. So when it does rain, it just kind of rolls on into the rivers and into the ocean at a time when, quote, it's not really needed, because when you really need that water is in the kind of hot summers when there's basically no rain whatsoever. So this is a crisis, essentially, that California is facing, as are other southwestern states like Arizona, New Mexico, and other areas that grow agriculture reliant on irrigation.
So that's going to translate into, of course, higher food prices and more expensive crop insurance to the U.S. taxpayer. But I want to move on. You mentioned these tree crops. Trees themselves figure very importantly in your book, Mark Shapiro, in The End of Stationarity. You have a discussion of the use of forests for carbon credits. And, you know, I know that when this idea first began, it was trumpeted as a very, very important way to save our forests, to make forests into carbon sinks. But the devil's in the details. So talk about some of the advantages and the problems, the challenges that have come out with this plan to trade preservation of forests for basically the license for other companies to emit carbon.
Yes, okay. Great. I'm glad you saw the tree connection here, because on the one hand, we're talking about trees that grow fruit crops, and that's in the Central Valley. And then we have the other question, and I visited the Amazon to write this book and talk about this question. Basically, a significant percent of greenhouse gases are released when trees are cut down and burned because they contain CO2. So the beautiful thing you realize, and you realize when you go into a forest, is that we are partners with trees. So this is not just a sentimental idea. It's fundamental to life here on Earth. Of course, we humans breathe in oxygen and exhale CO2, and trees inhale CO2 and exhale oxygen. It's just an incredible partnership. And of course, the most trees on Earth are basically down there in the Amazon, as well as in other kind of tropical rainforests. So to understand trees, think of them as enormous carbon sinks. That's why they're called carbon sinks, because trees, as well as a lot of the other living organisms in forests, living plants, absorb carbon dioxide, which is, of course, the most significant greenhouse gas. So in order to kind of reduce the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted into the atmosphere, you want as many trees standing as you could possibly have. You want to preserve trees standing so that they're absorbed with all those carbon dioxide in there, in the marrow of the trees. So in the Amazon, of course, is this incredible, rich ecosystem. And the challenge of the climate negotiators, how do you keep those trees standing? How do you prevent loggers from going in and logging those trees? How do you prevent big, huge areas of the Amazon being turned into farmland, cutting trees down and replacing with farmland? So a mechanism has been developed to enable fossil fuel companies to basically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by saying that they're emitting greenhouse gases, let's say in the United States or in Europe, over in one place, but we're preserving forests in another place, in this case, let's say the Amazon. So I went to some of these forest offsets. They're called offsets, offsetting emissions. And I went to some of these kind of literal offsets in the Amazon, and it gets extremely complicated once you get down there, because let's not forget, people live in the forest. Millions and millions of people live in the forest, many of them indigenous people who've been there for centuries. And so what we found and what I discovered and what I talk about in my writing on the forest preserves is how big companies, including in the United States, General Motors, Chevron, some of the biggest fossil fuel companies in America, including American Electric Power, which is a huge utility out there in the East Coast, all have actually invested funds in preserving, quote-unquote, preserving forest lands in Brazil, both in the Atlantic Forest and in the Amazon. And one of the impacts of this is to take the forest as a functioning ecosystem that actually sustains people who live there, because if you live there, you're not permitted to even cut down a tree to build a house or to harvest fruits from trees or to create firewood, to create fire. You're not allowed to kind of cut a tree down for any purpose whatsoever if you are a person who happens to live there. So this has created enormous tension with the indigenous communities that live in forests, not only in the Amazon, but also in Africa, Indonesia, and elsewhere. And the world is essentially grappling with this question now of how do we kind of preserve forests to actually hold on to their CO2 and facilitate the ability of indigenous tribes who've been living in those forests to continue living there as they have done for thousands of years. There's a slow awakening, I think, in the world, and I do talk about this in the book, to the fact that some of the most preserved forests in the world are those where indigenous people live and have found ways to interact with the forest, to use those resources in the forest, and do it in a sustainable fashion. And so you've had for some years now, too many years, I think, big fossil fuel-heavy companies going into the Amazon and other places and saying we're preserving the forest and excluding the people who have lived there from those forests. Now, slowly, there's beginning to be, I think, reforms to this process, which I also describe in there, where the forest, the rights of indigenous people who are not exploiting the forest in any crude way to continue living there is also being acknowledged. This is one of the big tension points in the global negotiations right now.
You know, I've done a little bit of research and writing about this issue of forest credits. Another issue is corruption, is just kind of the manipulation of the language to use forests that would not have been cut down anyway for credits, or to plant monocultural forests, you know, say palm oil plantations, which are not particularly good for the environment either, to cut down the old growth and to plant these monocultures. I wonder if you could address the issue of corruption when it comes to things like carbon credits.
Yes, there have been. I've written a lot about this, and there's a lot in the End of Stationarity about this. I mean, the days of the carbon market were like kind of cowboy days where, you know, a company, a big fossil fuel heavy company would come in and try to, quote, preserve the forest. There would be payoffs to local leaders to enable them to claim credit for, you know, 10,000, 50,000 acres of a forest in Brazil, in Peru. Some of the things happen in Peru. Some of the things happen in Tanzania. Interpol has even set up a kind of an environmental crime unit to actually look into how manipulated this entire market has been, and then also enabling companies to basically, quote, invest in the carbon rights, an entire new commodity, as I think you're referencing, Francesca, has been created, which are carbon credits in forests. So companies will go in and not buy the forest per se, but they'll buy an entirely new invention called the right to the carbon in the trees. So the right to the carbon in the trees is now a new commodity. And that commodity is such an abstracted commodity that it's been subject to enormous amount of manipulation in the financial markets and has led to great abuses on the ground when you purchase, you meaning a big fossil fuel company, purchases the rights to the carbon in the trees. But guess what? There happen to be people living amongst those trees that after they've been, the rights to the carbon have been purchased. So there's been an enormous amount of tension and abuses of that system. And I think this concept of how we actually both preserve the trees, which I think is extremely important principle to actually keep those trees standing. They are not only the lungs of the Earth, as we put it, but they're also the most important carbon-absorbing capacity that we have on the planet, while respecting the rights of people who live there and not to allow fossil fuel companies to abuse their position by claiming they're preserving trees one place while continuing to pollute somewhere else. This is a fundamental equity question that is being fought out now. There's no accident when some of you might have paid attention to some of the climate rallies that have been going on across the world, including the one in New York last year, and ones that continue to happen all over the world are often led by indigenous people. And certainly the New York rally, I remember the indigenous community was at the forefront of that rally. And the reason is exactly what you're talking about here, the attempt to utilize forests and extract to enable pollution to continue in the richer countries by preserving, quote unquote, preserving forests in the poorer countries. And this is a area of enormous kind of tension, which I write about in The End of Stationarity, where suddenly a thing that also had been without value, and I mean without economic value, which was essentially the trees and the ecosystem of tropical forests, now have enormous value, not only because they are critical to absorbing all that CO2, but also have a lot of economic value to companies that are attempting to kind of offset their emissions. And this is one of the basic fundamental battles that is continuing to happen.
And of course, we all know that indigenous people are leading the fight to protect our water, as well as with the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yes.
You end this book on a hopeful note, we started out talking about the Paris Agreement. You end with the Paris Agreement. You say it's an attempt to create a new stationarity. But there is a gap between the Paris Agreement's pledges and its goal of a 2 degrees limit rise. Talk about the hope that you see in the agreement, as well as the challenges to actually make it work to conform with the science.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think let's take the bad news first. And the bad news first is essentially that the global agreement that was reached in Paris is very unlikely to keep us to 2 degrees. So I think it's probably a very important and sad, and as it might be, to acknowledge that this kind of 2 degree limit, or even the 1.5 degree limit, we're way past the 1.5 degree. I don't think there's, I'm sorry to say, any chance that we're going to meet that range. And the current trajectory suggests we will blow past 2 degrees. So this is important, number one, because I think it's important we face that reality. And it's a disturbing reality, and I think it just means that the consequences of climate change are going to continue to accelerate. Now, that said, where is the good news? The good news is that the Paris Accord provided a historic agreement, which never before has, number one, the entire world, 195 countries, agreed on the principle of squeezing out fossil fuels from our energy matrix. A very important principle was also reached in Paris to decouple the idea of economic development from fossil fuels. So never before has essentially the entire world agreed that fossil fuels are not an essential ingredient in the economic development of less developed countries, which want to and justifiably want to have economic progress in their homes. And for the first time, the world essentially agreed that fossil fuels are not essential to that process, which means the whole world has to begin moving rapidly towards reliance on renewable energy. And the reason why the Paris Accord is so important, and why I end on a hopeful note, is that a mechanism that had not existed before, and I got this, by the way, I talked at great length to the representative of South Africa, which is, of course, one of these countries that's both on a pretty rapid course of development, but is obviously not a developed country at the level of the United States or Europe, so they're somewhere in the middle. And what was very interesting in talking with the South Africans as well as other country representatives in that situation is you have a accord which for the first time gives real voice to developing countries, gives an equal platform to developing countries to deal with and cooperate and challenge developed countries, a whole new framework established for this. There's a kind of a five-year benchmark to continually check in on how the world is moving towards less reliance on fossil fuels. There was a very powerful signal sent to the market about how fossil fuels are going to be diminishing in value. We actually see that in the markets now where money is beginning to move away from fossil fuels. Is it happening fast enough? We need to ask what is fast enough. What we're trying to do is move the world away from fossil fuels. So in terms of a move away from fossil fuels, which will, in the end, slow down the impact of climate change, I think Paris was a success. If you want to hold us to a hard 2-degree goal, it is not going to do that. And so we need to acknowledge these kind of bundle of things that are all happening at the same time. On the one hand, we are dealing with a world that is already in the throes of climate change, which requires enormous political and economic changes, which is what the subject of my book is about. That's why I call it the end of stationarity. We're in this new period when all these changes are afoot in the political and economic landscape. So we have to acknowledge that on the one hand, we are in this climate change period. It's impacting, it's rewriting the rules, the economic and political rules. At the same time, the levels of agreement, the levels of technological innovation are happening. At the same time, we've missed essentially the 2-degree cutoff point, I think. And that is a very sobering realization, and we have to actually start dealing with this world that is going through these changes now. So this is a kind of a combination of elements where I end up on the one hand, a note saying, let's be realistic. How are we going to deal with a world that is dealing with this 2-degree reality? And the other hand, changes and real reforms are underway that are going to kind of ultimately kind of slow this process down and bring us towards a global energy system that has far less collateral environmental damage.
Well, I hope you are right.
That combination.
Yes. Well, Mark Shapiro, it's just been fascinating to talk with you about this all-important issue to us. Your book is The End of Stationarity, Searching for the New Normal in the Age of Carbon Shock. Thank you so much for this fascinating discussion.
Thank you, Francesca.
Mark Shapiro. I checked in with him for a post-election comment. This is what he sent. Quote, there's no question that the election of Donald Trump and what appears to be a litany of fossil fuel executives and lobbyists he's put in charge of climate policy puts a significant brake on the progress that had been made in Paris, which itself was the fruit of over 20 years of climate negotiations. That said, there's also no question that the accelerating impacts of climate change should provide a jarring wake-up call to all Americans as the costs and consequences intensify. And those of us living under a Trump presidency will discover the hard way that fossil fuel production has indeed already been decoupled from economic progress. And that was Mark Shapiro in a post-election comment. To read an excerpt from The End of Stationarity, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Gumshoe journalist Greg Palast. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Donald Trump went around before the election claiming it was going to be rigged. Then he won the Electoral College vote, and his wild accusations died down. But now that a recount is scheduled in Wisconsin and possibly other states, thanks to the efforts of Jill Stein, the Donald is back to his utterly baseless claims that the popular vote, which he lost, was rigged. Well, my next guest, investigative journalist Greg Palast, agrees that the election was rigged. Only it wasn't about voters casting ballots more than once, as Trump says, but about millions of minority, poor, and young voters being denied their right to vote. His new movie and book about the massive voter suppression efforts of the Republican Party and their billionaire donors is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, a tale of billionaires and ballot bandits. I spoke to Palast in September when the movie premiered, before the election. But we'll post an update with him about the recount effort at our website, writersvoice.net. What follows is an edited version of our conversation. You can hear the full interview at our website. We jump in here at the point where I ask Greg Palast about Trump's claims about voter fraud. Trump, by the way, has been saying that this election is going to be rigged. Now, in the beginning, he didn't really specify what he meant, but more recently, he's been actually channeling the whole idea of voter fraud.
Yes.
This is something you really tackle. It's a central idea. Explain what voter fraud is, and more importantly, what the hysteria over voter fraud is.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump says the election's rigged, and he ought to know because his buddies are rigging it. And in particular, he has said that the way that they're rigging it, that the way the election is being rigged, is by people voting multiple times. He says people are voting many, many times. Well, if you vote more than once in election, yeah, that is a federal crime. So, Donald, where did you get the idea that people are voting many times? It's from his operatives, these Republican GOP operatives like Chris Kobach, who's the Secretary of State of Kansas. He's like the Catherine Harris of 2016. And he has taken the voter rolls of 30 Republican states, put them together, and found the double voters lurking in the American electorate. And there are 7 million suspects on his list, 7 million people. And what they're doing is the GOP is systematically removing these people from the voter rolls. They don't know it. They don't realize that they're being thrown off the voter rolls because they've been accused of voting twice. They get no notice of this. But I investigated. I said, give me the list of these terrible double voters, and you'll see this in the film. This the one big story that keeps going through the film is my hunt for those who are creating these lists and who's behind them, etc. So they're creating these lists, and there are 7 million people on the suspect list. They wouldn't give it to me because they said, well, it's confidential because it's a criminal investigation. I said, you have 7 million suspects in a crime? Really? You want to give me some of those names? No. Have you arrested anyone? No. Why? It's hard to find them. I said, how is it hard to find people who vote twice? You got their addresses, and they walk into the voting booth. They just cuff them. The reason they don't arrest any of these suspects, is that they didn't commit the crime. Their only crime is voting while black or brown or Asian. And what it is it's a list. I finally got my hands on it, as you see in the film. And this gives away nothing because there's so many stories in there in The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I get my hands on 2 million of their suspect names. And we have run through the list. And first of all, we find out it's people like Maria Isabel Hernandez, who votes in Virginia, supposed to be the same exact voter as Maria Cristina Hernandez, who votes in Louisiana. Now, are these the same person? Is she like Maria sneaking around and having a different middle name? Or is it the problem that it's just a common name? Well, it's not a common name for Republicans. So Maria Hernandez, Jesse Jackson, James Brown, David Lee, David Wong, you're getting the picture.
Yeah, in fact, you say as much as 20% of voters of color in certain states, like, is it Ohio, are actually on this list. I mean, if you purge 20% of the voters on a voter list, and if they tend to vote Democratic, Ohio's a swing state.
Exactly. Ohio, North Carolina, Arizona. These are the top swing states that are going to determine not only the presidency, but even more important, the United States Senate. These are the hottest Senate races, Ohio and North Carolina and Arizona, and the other states using this cross-check purge system of scrubbing the voters white, the voter rolls whiter than white. And so, yeah, you're up to, in some states, 1 in 5 minority voters. Throughout the 30 states, 1 in 8 Asian Americans. Why? Especially, and it's even worse in the Korean community. Now, why would they go after Asian Americans? They used to vote Republican. They switch. They vote as if they've turned black. And you see that in the film when they, there's this thing called voting Gangnam Style, and you got these Korean kids doing a hip hop, and then suddenly one of them turns into John Lewis because they're turning black as voters. And, you know, so the film is meant to expose this, and the book that goes with it are meant to expose this creepy thing of removing voters of color through this trick of saying, oh, James Brown literally voted 288 times in Georgia, or is it just a common name? You have to understand, if you're black, you're going to get about 1 in 7 black people are going to be handed something called a provisional ballot, which doesn't get counted, doesn't have to be counted, because your name's on the voter roll. They don't like your ID, anything. They say, oh, don't worry, so you don't scream. They give you this thing called a provisional ballot. I call it a placebo ballot. For example, if your name's not on the voter roll and you fill out a placebo ballot, provisional ballot, you think you voted. But if you're not on the voter roll, you're not on the voter roll. They can't count your vote. But even if they killed your registration because they falsely accused you of voting another time, falsely accused you of being an alien. This is the trick that they use on Hispanics. Right? They say, oh, well, on the deportation list, there's a guy named Jose Hernandez. You're Jose Hernandez. They know you're not that Jose Hernandez, but it's an excuse to knock off your vote. It's cheap. It's crappy. It's low. It's apartheid. But it's not the old type of redneck racism that kept black people from voting 50 years ago. This is new and sophisticated. These are billionaires funding programs which take away the votes of minorities or students or lower working class people. These are people that are hostile to the system. They got to get them off the voter roll. So they use all these tricks. And my job as a reporter for many years is to expose the tricks and the people and the fat cats who are funding this stuff and profiting from it.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Greg Palast about his new movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. You just said you talked to the billionaires behind it. You've mentioned John Paulson. Mm-hmm. There's another guy you talk about in the film who you actually wrote a book in which he prominently figured, and that's Paul Singer, the Vulture. Mm-hmm. Talk about his connection to this whole voter suppression thing.
Paul Singer, known as the Vulture, and I think...
Why?
Because well, you'll see in the film, I take you with me to the Congo and to Latin America, and I go to a cholera clinic. There are people dying of cholera still in the Congos. There's two nations, the Congos. Why? They don't have clean water. Why? They've been given money by the U.S. Treasury and European Union for... So what happened to that money? It was seized by this guy called the Vulture. And he got the name the Vulture because his vulture finance attacks, as they're known. He grabs poor nations, poor companies, poor people, grabs hold their old debts, and he becomes like an international repo man. And he'll say, unless you pay me, and not just pay me for some old debt or bonds, once he gets control, he demands 100 or even 1,000 times what he paid. He extorts money. And when I use the term extortion, I'm quoting the United States Treasury calls him an extortionist. The United States Treasury. He took, as you'll see in the film, the Vulture. The singer, the Vulture, actually secretly grabbed a hold of General Motors parts division, Delphi, financially while they were in crisis, and told the U.S. government, unless you give me $12 billion, me and my friend JP, the guy that wrecked the mortgage market, unless you give us $12 billion, we are going to literally cut off GM's parts. You won't have any parts. GM was in bankruptcy. It would have liquidated, and you'd have had 500,000 jobs just disappear. So Obama told the Treasury you got to pay him. It's extortion. And they screamed. The U.S. Treasury called it extortion. They don't have, by the way, big politics, these guys. They support Democrats, support Republicans. But right now, it's to their advantage to support Republicans for the most part. And the easiest way to support a Republican is get rid of a black guy off the voter rolls.
Now, you mentioned Delphi. You also go to a church where, am I right, there are workers who were laid off from Delphi who are then, you know, they try to go and do early voting on a Sunday. Do I have this right?
So what happened there is that I want to take you to see the billionaire's victims. As I say in the film a couple times, there's no such thing as a victimless billionaire. So when Paul Singer, the vulture, and JP, the foreclosure king, extort $12 billion from the U.S. Treasury to keep open General Motors, they then moved every single union job to China. Every single union job was shifted overseas. So towns like Dayton, Ohio, are completely demolished. But you can't take away someone's job and take away their hopes, destroy their lives without taking away their vote, because they'll vote against you. They'll say, we're for Bernie. Even for Trump is just, you know, wild, you know, they, whether you agree with that or not, they are going to vote in reaction to being ripped off. And so you have to stop them from voting. So, for example, there's a church where it's almost everyone in the church was a Delphi worker, the Freedom Faith Missionary Baptist Church of Dayton. And I showed up. I just showed up, by the way. They're very kind. You see the woman say, would you like to join us for services? I say, sure. And it's great. You know, you get the great gospel music. And then they all, it's Souls to the Polls Day. This is, now I flash back to 2012. Souls to the Polls Day. I get in the church van with them, and we go off to early voting in Ohio. And what happens? We get to Dayton. Now, on the day when white people vote, which is the Tuesday, which is what we call normal election day, black people don't get the day off, or they don't have wheels, so they have to go on the Sunday for early voting. On white voting day, there were 176 polling stations in the Montgomery area, in the Dayton-Montgomery County area. On the Souls to the Polls Day, the Republican state elections chief ordered that there be only one single polling station per city. So all of Cleveland had one polling station. All of Dayton had one polling station, and you can see in the film, I'm walking along this line, 80,000 people, almost all of them black folk, were told to wait in line for a single polling station. The county elections chief was going crazy. He knew, and I said, why are they doing this? And he said, because they can challenge these votes. Dig this, they wait in line 5 hours, and they don't get to vote. They were ordered not to let people vote, but to give them absentee ballots. Now, you understand, they're not absent. This is an official polling station. They've waited 5 hours. They get a number, and when their number is called, they get an absentee ballot. They fill out the application for an absentee ballot. They wait in another line, get an absentee ballot, fill that out, stick it in the envelope. They don't make them put a stamp on it because they're right there in the office. They just hand it in. Now, why would they do that? One, 5 hours hoping to discourage you. Second, making this a complicated process. And third, in the middle of the night, I drive in the middle of the night to Professor Bob Fitrakis' house, a voting rights expert, and he said, my God, this is horrible, because if you vote, it's in the machine, you vote. But if you hand in an absentee ballot, you're playing roulette, because you have to fill out all these forms. Any stray mark on an absentee ballot, any stray mark on the form, you forgot your middle initial, you forgot that you registered with your middle initial, you're dead. You added junior when you registered, but you didn't sign it junior when you did the absentee ballot. Or you signed the junior and you didn't when you registered and you didn't remember. Or it says you have to add your driver's license. If you leave it blank because you don't have a driver's license, they disqualify your ballot. You're supposed to say no driver's license. But they don't tell you that. So it's all these tricks. And over a million absentee ballots. People mail in their ballots. Don't go postal. But they did this because they knew that this was the black voting day. So you have an apartheid voting system in America. It's all about being able to manipulate that vote. And that's why Karl Rove went crazy back in 2012, because he said he called the Secretary of State. And I heard his entire statement that night. He was talking about the early voting. And he says, Well, we're going to have to take a look at those early votes, because he thought that they were going to challenge 200,000 black votes. Well, we busted it, and we went when I did that report, Bob Fitrakis actually went into a federal court that morning and busted the scheme.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're airing an edited version of our interview with investigative reporter Greg Palast about his film and book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. We spoke in September before the election.
So you're talking about how they are challenging these votes, they're purging voters, absentee ballots is, you know, Russian roulette with a ballot. Talk about the Voting Rights Act and how the decision in 2013 to strike down a key provision, I believe it was 4B of the Voting Rights Act, how that has made things so much worse now as we're going into the 2016 election.
In 2013, the Supreme Court cut the guts out of the Voting Rights Act. And literally, within hours, not even days, within hours, Alabama and a bunch of other states changed their laws because they no longer were under federal scrutiny to prove that they're not discriminating against voters of color. So literally within hours, they started going back to the old Jim Crow laws. For example, this whole system of looking for hunting for double voters, removing them from the voter rolls, called cross-check, that could have never spread until that Voting Rights Act was pulled out of the way. So cross-check suddenly started traveling around the country like a virus till it grew to 7 million suspects. And we're going to have a million people who are going to show up at the polling stations in November. They're not going to be on the voter rolls. They won't even know why. Then all these new voter ID laws, I go in the film, I go to Alabama, and within literally 2 hours after the court decision came down, Alabama passed a law requiring that everyone have, if not a driver's license, a identification card from the Department of Motor Vehicles. And then within another day, they closed almost every DMV in the 10 black belt counties, the 10 counties where most black people live in Alabama. They simply said, okay, you need to have a DMV certificate, and we're closing all the DMV offices. So this is one of the tricks. And then I go meet with Senator Hank Sanders, who was one of the original marchers with Martin Luther King. And one of the things that's great about America, here was a guy whose parents couldn't vote. He couldn't vote. The King began his march for voting rights in Selma, Alabama. And by the time he arrived in Montgomery, we had the president backing the Voting Rights Act. So we end up with Sanders becoming a state senator. So Senator Sanders calls me up and said, Greg, I've been removed from the voter rolls, and I'm a state senator. This is really getting out of control. And they said, if they can do that to me, they can do it to anyone. So then we go back, and how do we overcome this? And how do we overcome it? And there's that song, We Shall Overcome.
Greg Palast is an investigative reporter whose book appears on BBC Television, The Guardian, and Rolling Stone magazine. On December 3rd, we'll post an update with him about the recounts at writersvoice.net. And we'll link to the full interview with him that we did in September. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.